All right, hi everyone. My name's Will. So hi to everybody I haven't said hello to yet, but I hope to say hello to everybody by the end of the day. It gives me a great pleasure and honour to introduce Chris. That makes it sound like I've known Chris for years. In fact, I've known him for 5 minutes. So what I'm saying about him is simply what he told me to tell you. Chris, I think you did your PhD on Cormac McCarthy, is that right?
I did, yeah.
So you probably know a lot more about him than I do, which is great. But your background, I think, is religion, and especially in post-secularity, is that right?
Yeah, and literature.
And I think what I particularly like what you told me is you said, look, I'm a writer, I'm a poet, I'm not a philosopher. I thought, thank God for that. So, over to you, Chris.
Thank you. Yeah, so, like I say, I tend to approach these things with quite a scatty kind of aesthetic and poetic eye, so I'm quite aware that I'm always quite anxious and nervous talking to a crowd of philosophers as if I'm just a poet who's about to sort of earn his own ejection from the sort of the Republic sort of in front of you. And as Will says, my background is in religion and religious philosophy generally and literature, which is kind of the lens which I'm always reading McCarthy through. And sometimes this is a sort of... So I'm guessing those of you who've read McCarthy, and we've already talked about the religion here, you have to be kind of careful about which religious signifiers and codes draw your eye, because sometimes there's lots of red herrings there and there's lots of subversion and... if you like, evasion going on in the way that he uses these tropes. And that's really what interests me, really, particularly with the sort of like the body of post-secular thought that I do get engaged with. I'm interested in where religious idiom, religious ideas, and religious, if you like, sciences of thought are kind of being brought back, particularly modern Jewish thought, actually, which is an area which I've got to touch on here, kind of come to the fore and are transformed or subverted. And I think McCarthy's fiction, in a way, kind of performs a little bit of that. The thoughts I had reading the article kind of really touch on this sort of perennial question of Gnosticism in McCarthy. And had I been a bit more sort of prepared and thought about it, I would have armed myself to come and give a complimentary part to what Patrick was talking about and provided a kind of a history of the ideas of opposition and collaboration between nature and grace in the history of Jewish and Christian and biblical thought that might have sort of citrus as what's going on there, because I think in truth McCarthy, just to sort of answer that last point where Patrick finished on, McCarthy is someone who I don't think has a kind of a consistent ontology and religious or otherwise. I do read him as someone who's got a sort of a Catholic mind of, if you like, natural sufficiency of grace and nature incorporated, but it's also channeled through this kind of, if you like, Protestant schism between nature and grace as well, which comes into this sort of like the Baconian imagination that he's got as well, of where nature becomes about forces and bodies colliding and things like that, rather than, if you like, higher forms of agency in collaboration. But the question I wanted to really address, well, the questions that I was arising when I was reading this article, which again, like everyone I've spoken to today, I found kind of peculiar, kind of to read what's going on, what's been answered, which, you know, like all of us sort of needy McCarthy scholars who get very little from the man himself to go on, you read it thinking, what can this do for me? What can this give me? What questions have I got? Will this answer? And it's frustrating because there's some very, very, some things which I felt kind of like, if I like, kind of satisfied hunches that I had and things that I found kind of frustrating. But I really want to talk about this question, again, I'm trying to link everything I'm saying in with what Patrick was saying, the question about whether the unconscious is benign and what the relationship of the unconscious is to language and what that means for the assessment that he makes of language. So the kind of two figures who I had in mind when I was reading this were Walter Benjamin and Giorgio Agamben, two figures who are very interested in language and human language and very interested with each other's thought, actually. Well, obviously, reversing Agamben goes back to Benjamin, particularly early Benjamin, where Benjamin is kind of under a spell of certain Gnostic if you like, sentiments, and I think which stuff which he's kind of like picking up in his sort of revisions of Schmitt, and what have you. But there is this sort of early, wonderful early work of Benjamin's called On the Nature of Language as Such and the Nature of Man, in particular, which is very well known, where we do see him sort of waking up to a sort of a more subtle Jewish gnosis or Jewish understanding of how language and nature are kind of partnered. But the kind of the question that if you like, joins Benjamin and Agamben's thinking about language and thinking about nature is that they're both describe language as a sort of, for want of a better word, sort of a divine technology. So Benjamin goes back to the sort of, he gives a sort of exegesis of the sort of story of creation from Genesis, where the world comes into being through the process of namings and language, which he then uses as springboard for how the human naming of things kind of, if you like, finishes, if you like, or kind of continues that sort of work of creation. And for him, the naming is part of bringing forth the essence of things into this sort of medial frame of language. Agamben does something opposite to this. When he looks at these resources, he's interested in this divine technology, but obviously he's interested in this sort of godly technology for a god who doesn't exist. And he instead opts to talk about human language as what he, if you like, the major instrument of what he describes as the anthropogenic machine. And I think the use of machine there is really interesting. It's a language is the way in which human beings sort of authenticate or sort of satisfy the need to sort of impose differentiation in the world and impose hierarchy on the world, really. So our idea of the human is dependent upon how we circumscribe the idea of the animal in names and being. And he has a fascinating method of this, of going back through history. He's quite Derridian, even though he has I'll come back to Derrida in a minute. He going back into sort of the history of ideas up to the present, even up to, as far as like Martin Heidegger, he's questioning what is going on and what is the real agenda between our ascription and our portioning of, if you're the way we portion shares in world to animals and things like that. So what are we doing? Language here is the way in which we are securing ourselves against this. So how this relates to the sort of the Gnostic question to me, and how it kind of all turns, actually I should backtrack a moment to come back, is there's a common ancient Gnostic who both Agamben and Benjamin, and the early Benjamin, very interested, often by way of a 19th century Swiss anthropologist called Backofen, who a lot of people have had going back to and looking at now as sort of an alternative 19th anthropologist. I'm interested in a figure called Basilides of Alexandria. Gnosticism is a tricky word, and I avoid it as much as I can, because those of you, anyone who spent any amount of time looking through the breadth of ancient ideas and religious movements that are collected under this umbrella of Gnosticism will find that there's important, significant differences. Basilides is interesting because he shares what we talk about as one of these sort of common Gnostic ideas, which is a sort of a distinction between spirit and matter, and interestingly between language and matter, or if we like, logos and flesh, or word and flesh is an important distinction to him. What sets him apart is he is the only really Gnostic thinker of that period in the first century Alexandria who thinks about the fate of the natural body after the separation of, if you like, the return of the divine spark to, if you like, the heavenly heights. And for him, there's this kind of like great peace. He writes about how this sort of great, if you like, peacefulness will come over the sort of the natural creation once the divine element or divine language has been sort of taken apart. And Agamben is obviously very interested in this because for him, if you like, the completion of the philosophical project of language will be to, if you like, rid ourselves of language. And this is And this is why I'm interested to see how the place of the unconscious sort of sits here as a sort of, whether this will be a sort of, in McCarthy's eyes, a sort of abiding kind of motor, which is sufficient as to life of survival, but is, which is in there. So again, this is why I want to know whether it's benign and what quality of benignity this is. It's sort of a benignity which is sort of sufficient to itself. So Bastylides and Agamben talk about how our animal nature is tormented by our use of language and our reliance on language and our reliance on ordering the world. And in McCarthy's fiction, I wonder if there is this sort of move, and occasionally there's this flirting with a sort of Basilidean image or a sort of Agamben-esque vision of, if you like, the completion or the idea of the redeemed material existence of things, in which there is mind, but it's not the mind of inquiry and naming. Sorry, I promised you this was going to be a scatty sketch going through. So I wonder where naming for McCarthy fits in. At times it seems like, and this is what I was trying to pull up from out of this article about what he's talking about naming, because obviously throughout the fiction, naming seems hugely significant, but often seems kind of negligible as well. So I think about the infant in Outer Dark, who apparently dies for a lack of a name more as much as anything else in lacking what sort of Walter Benjamin and also Franz Wolzenzweig would talk about as a sort of failure to sort of bring that child into the sort of world of medial relations through language by ascribing it a name. So the child sort of remains in sort of undifferentiated nature. Likewise, Blood Meridian's sort of, there's a wonderful passage in there where we see the sort of the collapse of priorities and the collapse of hierarchies in the natural landscape, and it was sort of evoked under the sort of guise. There's a phrase used about sort of describing this sort of flat terrain, this optical democracy, as a time before nomenclature. So this, whether there is this sort of sufficiency in nature without name. And likewise in The Road, we get a sense of this sort of like hierarchy of being and then naming in reverse. So there's a reference to kind of things go out of existence and are followed by their names as well. So it's kind of turned backwards on itself. The question I have about then McCarthy's use of the unconscious is, he talks about it sort of being resistant to kind of like our interrogation of it, and I wonder whether this resistance is a sort of a refusal to be sort of antagonized by our sort of our naming and our desires to use language and our desires to construct narrative, and narrative with kind of takes us out of a sort of circular mythic sense of the material world, or whether in fact, and in that case, whether that sort of benignity, which we've kind of like talked about there, is about, if you like a natural sense of mind, a natural condition that needs to be sort of left to its own devices, with sort of things like names and stories being kind of like permanently banished from it, or whether there is in the unconscious a sort of an incipience towards language and a sort of predisposition towards naming, which again would be something to talk about, which we might frame in terms of grace and nature, as opposed to grace or nature, whether there is something sort of lurching out of that sort of unconscious, and whether the resistance there, that you, the resistance that the unconscious has in order to kind of communicate with conscious language, is one of kind of stretching and trying to make supple what is provided to it. That's kind of about as much as I wanted to give you, really. I wanted to just kind of get a sort of feeder conversation about these things, if that's all right.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Strangely enough, when I read it, I immediately thought of Benjamin's famous essay. But one of the things I've got two things really to ask you, really. One is that I kind of think, although he writes the piece in the language of science, especially biology, evolutionary biology and linguistics. I think what he's talking about is myth. And what I was interested in is, of course, there's people like Benjamin aren't scared to talk about it in the language of myth. Because I kind of think it's a bit silly talking about what was there before language. Mm. As soon as one begins that, one is in a kind of mythic. And the other thing is, so, you know, why does he use the language of science, where these other people, of course, you're talking about, we'll talk about in terms of myth, and don't have to naturalize it in that sense. And whenever we talk about nature anyway, it always involves a kind of mythic language. And the second question is I think what you're alluding to at the end, which is more of a kind of, I suppose, a logic, which might be there in Gnosticism. It's, do you think that the way that he presents the relationship between the unconscious and language is just a bit too oppositional? I find it very difficult to think of that the way that he described it. It's very difficult to think, well, how do they communicate then? If they're so different from one another, in what sense would they communicate? In other words, that I was very interested at the end, you were saying that mustn't there be within the unconscious a kind of predisposition towards speaking? Well, that means there must be a kind of, if you like, an immaterial element imminent in matter. Matter itself, in some sense, has to desire to express itself. Otherwise, why would the unconscious be talking to us? But if it isn't a language, what is it saying? So I was wondering whether you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah.
Because I'm asking you questions, I don't have an answer.
No. Okay, so start with the first question about why use the idiom of science and why blend it all in myths. I agree. It sounds peculiar. There's a slippage between science and myth, and of course I read it all as, again, with the sort of 20th century kind of Jewish thought or kind of like crypto-religious philosophy of Frankfurt School. So I'm always sensitive to something like Adorno and Horkheimer talking about science and logic has become myth, as a re-mythification. And I think they're accurate in the way that they describe how the era of enlightenment has actually entailed a return of mythic forms. Return of mythic forms over what I would oppose to that, or what someone like Benjamin or Rosenzweig would oppose to that, as a return of mythic forms over exotic forms. So we've gone back into sort of circular immanentist thinking. We've gone back to Ouroboros. We've made rational science into the sort of an Ouroboros myth, rather than a story of exodus, of something, of an augmentation of nature, of a transformation of nature to something kind of moving beyond its origins. And that's kind of the way I've always kind of detected it in McCarthy's fiction. So someone like Judge Holden stands out as an example of someone who he's a mythic figure of the sort of false enlightenment, as kind of like Adorno and Horkheimer would talk about it. And he even seems to be, his version of enlightenment is about the re-mythification and the re-mystification of the world, you know, this idea of destruction of things, the concealment of things, rather than, and when knowledge of things is predicated on their destruction and sort of dissolution. So I'm reading the article again here, I'm wary of what he's talking about is science, and this is myth, and I'm reading as he's obviously someone who's got incredible scientific learning, but it's leaning into the mythological. I often see it like a parallel here, that those of you who've been able to read like the play Whales and Men, there's a character in that who is supposed to be a marine scientist, but it was always slipping into mythical speech and mythical speculation and magical speculation about these things. So I think on the one hand, for all his kind of like advocacy of science, you know, and his friendship with people drum beaters for enlightenment, like Lawrence Krauss and something like that, I think he's someone who kind of like secretly knows that scientific discussion is always, if you like, rigged to kind of like collapse into the mythical or something like that. So I think that's part of it in there. And the kind of, I hope that's part of the answer. And so the second part of your answer about So the back of your question was about the unconscious, where the unconscious is sort of leaning in towards the sort of language. Yeah, again, I think he's not sure, and this is why I kind of I made that point to start with, sort of answering kind of where Patrick goes. So I don't think there is a consistent metaphysic here. It's not classical Gnostic, it's not New Agey, it's not Theravada Buddhist or anything like that that we might throw at it. It's not the perennial philosophy or anything like that. What we've got is quite, I'd say, it sounds kind of condescending to say it's a confused mind about these things, but I don't mean it's confused. I mean, like, I think he is someone who is plays with oppositions to see what's at stake. And so, which again, which is why it's interesting that in this science journal, he ventures this sort of, if you like, he seems to be at times sort of like refuting dominant evolutionary accounts of language and saying there is just seems to be this inclination towards speech. There does seem to be this way in which we move forwards. I could give another answer to work that out, which is all about sort of the mechanics and the, if you like, the topography of the body of versions of Gnosticism and things like that, which we'll talk about, where the unconscious and language kind of come together. But to be honest, they don't really use those terms in ancient Alexandria very much. But what you would find in some of those sort of ancient dualisms is if you like, an opposition of languages. So kind of, so that if you like, the light, the divine element, which is confused and material, is also, in a sense, a confusion of languages. So things like logos, you know, kind of even a kind of like a, if you like, a Heraclitan or skeptical idea of, or Stoic idea of logos, I should say, is entertained within certain Gnosticism, but it's kind of like a false language. It's the language of the logic of nature, if you like, which... if you like, is kind of non-compatible, which is one of the problems with Gnosticism. Metaphysics doesn't quite work. It's almost like you've got a software in an incompatible hardware unit sort of thing. Well, how do they communicate to each other? How do they become disentangled? It's one of the reasons why a large way ancient Gnosticism runs out of intellectual steam, is they can't account for those things. But again, it's because they're just into leaning into this language, and just to sort of throw another little point out, which is kind of connected to all this. He does entertain the idea that there is language and writing in non-human nature as well. So if you've read like portions of The Crossing, and Whales and Men do talk about, and it's despite what he says in here about other mammals not having language, he does actually entertain the idea that there is actually some very sophisticated of like semic codes amongst animals, and where these are kind of actual kind of, where if you like, the communications of whales actually does model what it's supposed to represent rather than just being signals. Which is there in Whales and Men, and is there, which he gets from, what's his name, Payne, the whale biologist, who is his friends again. Where, and even in the fiction itself, there's writing all the time. Catch talk about there's writing on bodies, there's writing in nature, even if it's often intelligible or apparently asemic writing. So this is why one of the ambiguities at the end of the road of returning to those brook trout, which have got maps and mazes on them. You know, they've got symbols on them, but they're kind of unreadable. And the ambiguity of situating that on the end is whether we're seeing here, if you like, nature in its kind of incipient movement into sort of augmentation by language, or if we actually, that conclusion is a sort of Basilidean, Agambian kind of completion of the world. Actually, we've got rid of the human language, and the only language which will abide is this sort of non-language of sort of material animal existence, which is sufficient to itself and free of the torments of narrative, name, representation, and things like that.
Great, fantastic. Well, there's a lot of meat there, so... Oh, let's clap. Theatre.